This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In an assessment of his own work, Mark Twain wrote, "My works are like water. The works of the great masters are like wine, but everyone drinks water." Nearly a century after his death, Twain's impact on American literature is about as ubiquitous as water and as influential as wine. Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer, Life on the Mississippi, you can probably name half a dozen more. Twain may be second only to Shakespeare in the most thumbed sections of Bartlett's quotations and is universally acknowledged as a master of fiction, satire, commentary, and the killer one-liner. But theater? Over the course of a long career, Twain repeatedly tried to write for the stage. With one exception, he was a flop. But that may soon change. The never-before-published, still-never-produced play, Is He Dead?, hit bookstores in October, and there's already a Broadway producer searching for a company to stage it. Later in this program, we'll talk with the man who collaborated on the autobiography of Santa Claus. But first, we celebrate Mark Twain's birthday. He turned 168 yesterday with a look at his newly published comedy and his lasting influence on American literature. If you have questions about Twain and his books, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And we have a challenge for our emailers in honor of this rediscovered play. Is there another of Twain's lesser-known works you think deserves a second or first look? Send us a short pitch and we'll try to present some of the less familiar Twainiana during our show. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is the researcher who brought Is He Dead out of oblivion and edited the new volume. Shelley Fisher Fishkin joins us from the studios of Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. She directs the American Studies Department there. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Tell us how you found this play. How lost was it?
Well, it wasn't exactly lost. It was buried at the back of a file in the Bancroft Library, and a handful of scholars had looked at it over the years. But I think because Twain had such a well-deserved reputation as a terrible playwright, I mean, all of his other efforts are really dreadful, they didn't really pay much attention to this, which was at the very back of the file. It was written near the end of his life, it was written in 1898, late in his life. It was the next to the last play that he ever tried to write. And I don't think that they really gave it the kind of attention that it deserves. It's great fun. It's a very unexpected work to emerge from this period of Twain's life. We tend to view his later years as filled with darkness, grim determinism, brooding pessimism. And indeed, just at the time when he was about to write this play, he was coming out of the worst depression of his life. His daughter Susie had passed away a year and a half before. He had been in bankruptcy and didn't know how he was going to get out of it. But then all of a sudden in January 1898, the cloud lifted. He had come up with a way of getting out of debt. His friend Henry Rogers had helped him figure out a way to satisfy the creditors. He was beginning to emerge from his grief over his daughter's death. And living in Vienna in 1898, he sat down to write a play. He was living in what was in many ways one of the theater capitals of the world at that time. He had seen a lot of extraordinary plays, and it inspired him to try yet again to write a play himself. And so he celebrated emerging from this this grief and depression by writing a rather over-the-top, wild, cross-dressing farce. And I certainly didn't expect to find that.
If I could summarize, the plot is a highly fictionalized account of the French painter Jean-François Millet and his starving fellow artists who then fake his death in a scheme to drive up the price of his paintings. The hijinks, as you mentioned, include cross-dressing, art criticism, social commentary, and more than a few jabs at the French. Sounds like a surefire hit. What happened?
Well, I think that Twain really thought he had done it this time. He said, "I don't know if I could write a play that will play, but this one will." And his wife liked it too. He said that she thought it was very bully. And with high hopes, he sent it off to his friend Bram Stoker, who is best known as the author of Dracula, but at the time was one of the best-placed people in the London theater world, the manager of the Lyceum Theater. And he was also a very close friend of Twain's for the last 15 years. And Stoker had agreed to be his agent in England, and he sent it off to Stoker. He seems to be completely completely unaware of the fact that just at the moment he sends the play to Stoker, Stoker has one of the worst catastrophe, well, the worst catastrophe of his professional life. All of the sets, costumes, and props for 250 plays burns to the ground. The storage theater, the storage unit of the Lyceum Theater catches fire. And Stoker's life in the theater changes forever, and he's a little distracted. And he writes back to Twain saying, well, I have to read it more carefully, but for now I don't think it's good for England. Maybe it's good for America. Try America.
And what happened there?
Well, Twain sends it to his agent in America, and he tries to place it. But there, the timing is a bit off as well. For one thing, by the spring of 1898, when it reaches agents in the States, producers in the States, the Spanish-American War has broken out, and Broadway is filled with patriotic plays, war plays, and it's probably not the time to introduce a cross-dressing farce. Also, the time is, he's a little late on the scene in terms of farce generally, because Charlie's Aunt, which it resembles in some ways, the enormous popular British comedy by Brandon Thomas, debuted in the States in 1893, and it was so hugely successful that it spawned lots and lots of imitations. And by the time Twain comes along in 1898, that kind of theater had really passed out of popularity. So he was really too late on that front, too. But another factor may be that it was a little more transgressive than Charlie's Aunt and than really any other cross-dressing farces at the time, because Twain didn't just take some anonymous Oxford undergraduates and dress them in drag. He took one of France's greatest painters and dressed him in drag for very good reasons, for two acts. And this might have been a little bit hard to take for a public that venerated Millet. He was a cultural icon that had enormous respect in this period, and that might have seemed a little bit too out there.
Millet, of course, best known for The Gleaners, I suspect, in this country, though another of his works, The Angelus, is the centerpiece of this particular play. I was curious, though, again, the plot involves Millet, they fake his death, and he goes into drag as a widow, to shows up at his own funeral, all that sort of stuff. But there's this wonderful moment in the play where Millet realizes that after staging his own death, that he's destined thereafter to remain forever a successful imitator of my own works. And as you point out, that's not something that could have been far from Twain's own mind. His best-known works were already behind him.
Yes, Twain often had the sense that he was an imitator of himself in some ways. He, at one point, signed a hotel register as Samuel L. S.L. Clemens, profession Mark Twain. And the question of, you know, who is the imposter or claimant, who is the original, what is identity, actually really intersects with a lot of the issues that come out in this play. These are issues that Twain is pondering in terms of his own career, and it's one that the play raises, because as these painters are painting painting imitation Millets and copies of the Angelus, the question becomes, well, who bought the real one, who bought the copy, and if Millet is going to come back as an imitator of himself, well, you know, what does that mean to be an imitator of yourself for the rest of your life?
Mm-hmm. By the way, if you'd like to see an excerpt from Is He Dead, you can go to the Talk of the Nation page on our website. That's at npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Deborah, who joins us from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi.
I find it amazing that most people do not know that Mark Twain wrote a book about Joan of Arc. And it was in an interview that he revealed that it was his favorite book that he wrote. He spent 13 years in France, according to this interview, studying for this book, studying the trial transcripts and all the notes that her page took and his diaries. It's absolutely riveting, and so I want to recommend it.
Oh, well, thanks very much, Deborah. Shelley Fishker-Fishkin, are you familiar with that one?
Yes, and it is a book that Twain liked much more than readers in our day like, but it's a book that that does have its fans. Twain had enormous admiration for Joan of Arc and also for Zola, who wrote his famous J'accuse just around the time that Twain was writing this play. And those two French figures whom he admired offset a little bit a lot of his prejudice against the French, which comes out throughout his work elsewhere and also in this play.
I think that was the basis of part of his prejudice against the French in reading and studying for that book.
Well, and Deborah, his assessment of it is his favorite. It may have been the one he was publicizing at the time, so don't overlook that possibility.
I guess it was marketing at all times.
At all times.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. Joining us now from his home in Connecticut is Broadway producer Bob Boyette. He runs Boyette Theatricals, and he's looking into mounting a production of Is He Dead? And thanks very much for being with us.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you're in the process of getting the play produced somewhere?
Yes. We're talking to regional theaters here in the United States about mounting initially a development project and a production at one of the local theaters.
Now, are you at all nervous considering Twain's track record in the theater?
Well, I think this is an exceptional property, and I must say, when Shelley and I initially talked, I was interested, and then every time I got more information about it, my enthusiasm just got ratcheted up because I like the social satire of the piece. I think it is great comedy. I happen to be a fan of farce. And so I think this is even more sophisticated, though, than the typical French farce. So I felt pretty committed, and we kept discovering things that we thought would be interesting in mounting it. And I think it's going to attract some very interesting actors who will come to it.
Twain, as we learn in the introduction afterward by Shelley Fisher Fishkin, thought at some point that maybe he needed a play doctor. And I was reading the play over the weekend, and some of the dialect, the stereotypical speech of Chinese and Dutch characters or German characters, might be a problem now.
Well, I think we intend to bring in someone. I mean, we want to collaborate on this project with a director and maybe a writer who shares, our vision of it, which is to, without taking too many liberties with the existing work, make a few necessary changes just for the ability to produce it practically, as well as maybe some of those issues. We haven't really gotten that far yet with it. But I think that what Shelley was saying earlier is that, there was some resistance before. I find now, we have a pretty open landscape in terms of what people are doing, whether it's politically correct or not, as long as it is in the spirit of real comedy. So some of those things might play a lot better today, will play a lot better today than they would have many years ago.
And it's not every producer who gets to put a new play by Mark Twain up on the marquee there.
Absolutely. And to your previous point, I mean, Twain did even admit that it needed some more work and has questioned himself. So he's sort of given us a license to do some things with it, which I think is great. I mean, I have done previous projects with playwrights that are dead or authors and composers that are dead, and I find that, dead people can be very difficult to work with, particularly the ones who, when they were 70 or 80, married a 20-year-old and they control all of their rights. But I think in this case, fortunately, we have a scholar who knows Twain well, and I think Shelley will always keep us straight about that. But I also want to attract, major talent to this so that they would appreciate what we're doing and help us, make it producible in today's world without really taking any of Twain's stamp away.
Bob Boyette, good luck.
Thank you.
Bob Boyette heads Boyette Theatricals. He joined us from his home in Connecticut. If you'd like to join us as we continue our conversation about Mark Twain, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at npr.org. After the break, writer Russell Banks will join us as we move from Twain's failed career on the stage to his remarkable legacy as a writer. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Mark Twain's lasting impact on American literature with Twain scholar Shelley Fishkin, who's with us from Stanford University in California. You're invited to join our discussion. The number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. We have an email challenge. Some of Twain's lesser-known work, we have a response here from Tom Baxter, who writes, "There's one bit of Mr. Twain's comedic output never taught in high school that certainly deserves mention. It's a very short piece called 1601, supposedly from the diary of a servant in the court of Queen Elizabeth. It retells the events of an afternoon party with various famous people of her day, and it's certainly not fit to read over the airwaves. Most of the jokes are either sexual or scatological in nature, but for anyone who is not easily offended, this is a side of Twain's personality we don't often see." Shelley Fishkin, I assume you're familiar with this.
Yeah, yes, I agree completely, and I think that anyone interested in 1601 should look for an edition of it that has an introduction by Erica Jong and an afterword by Leslie Fiedler that came out in the Oxford Mark Twain in 1996. And both of them really recognize that this work was in some ways a liberating venture, because Twain wrote this the same summer that he began Huck Finn. And Erica Jong's view is that he is trying to get his own personal censors off his back by writing a work that Leslie Fiedler refers to as pornography, or, you know, it's somewhat scatological and somewhat pornographic, but he's writing it for a private audience, a kind of men's club private audience, a group of his male friends. It's a work which Twain is also experimenting with language in. He's trying to see what the Elizabethans would sound like when they talk dirty. And he's really just trying to cut loose and have some fun. I think it's a piece worth reading, for sure.
Here's another one from Lynn Taylor. Given our current international circumstances, she writes, "The War Prayer, which was not published for a decade after he wrote it, is a must. Be sure to sit and read it with a child whose future you care about."
I think that's excellent advice. The War Prayer is an extraordinary piece. It's very compelling. It's as current today as it was when he wrote it, if not more so.
Joining us now is an author who can speak personally to Twain's influence. Russell Banks' 1995 novel, Rule of the Bone, tells the story of a wayward young white boy who goes journeying with an older black man. Russell Banks joins us now from his office in Keene, New York, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, when it came out, Rule of the Bone was celebrated as an update of Huckleberry Finn. What do you want to, why did you want to take that work on particularly?
Well, yeah, I didn't think of it as an update particularly. I thought of it more as an engaged dialogue with Twain and with Huckleberry Finn. I wanted to tell a story that tapped into some of the archetypes that Twain had used: a homeless boy, a drug-addled and abused homeless boy, because there were, first of all, so many of them around us at the time. And to have him travel through the country in the company of an adult black man, just to deal with some of the same themes, really, that Twain had made and had seen as so central to American life in the mid-19th century, because they still seem central to me in American life in the late 20th century.
Do you think Huck Finn is the greatest of his works?
Well, for me, personally, yes, I do. For a number of reasons, I guess, because for me, more than any other of his works, although he does it everywhere, he lifted American vernacular speech to the level of art in a way that had never had been done before, and made it possible for the rest of us who came afterwards to do the same. And also, I think, because of the themes, Twain, more than any author of his time, and maybe even more than any author of our time, face directly what I regard as a central truth of American life, that race was a central factor in our national story. Race and greed and hypocrisy in dealing with both race and greed seemed to him to be central to the American story, and they seemed to me to be central to the American story.
Shelley Fishkin, I wonder, what did Twain think of Huck Finn? Where did he put it in as he assessed his own work?
Well, it depends when you ask him. At one point in his life, he said that Huck Finn was his favorite work. So he was very fond of it. I think he had a deep affection for it. But he also knew that it was a book that was going to cause trouble. It caused trouble the moment it appeared. It was banned in Concord when it first came out. That cheered Twain enormously. He said, that'll sell 25,000 copies, sure. but he really, he did like the book. I don't know that he recognized that it would be the book that would have the most lasting impact on American culture, but he certainly was very fond of it.
Of course, the author's always the last one to know, anyhow.
Well, Russell Banks, is he still an inspiration to you? Do you think of him when you sit down to write?
I sort of do, actually. I wish he were still here. I wish we had him today to deal with our social and political realities today. I think his stance toward the world is one that I think of whenever I try to begin a new work. I want to take on his refusal to accept received truth. I want to take on his skepticism. I'd never be able to come near his humor. I have a wholly different sensibility. But that stance he took towards the world consistently is one that I think any writer today would want to emulate.
Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer are on the curriculum for most of American school children at one age or at one time or another. What do you think they should be learning from these books? And do we assign them too young? I mean, might people profit from them a little bit older?
Are you asking me? Actually, I think it should be assigned even younger than they are generally. I think that they would be great books to read at the age of 12 or 13. And for the reasons that I stated earlier, that the central stories in Huck Finn are the central stories of the lives of American kids today, and we need to keep being reminded of that.
Let's get another caller on the line. Tom joins us now from Soda Springs, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Tom.
Yeah, this is Tom. I'm calling in regard to a book to a story called The Mysterious Stranger. I ran across it about 35 years ago, and I've been looking for it ever since, and it's a very dark story.
The Mysterious Stranger is...
The Mysterious Stranger.
Yeah, my recollection is that it's God, isn't it?
Yes, who enjoys killing people, more or less.
An odd work, Shelley Fishkin.
Yeah, The Mysterious Stranger is published posthumously, and the University of California Press has the various manuscripts that Twain wrote, and it is a very, very odd and interesting and puzzling work, and in some ways a very funny work. Satan is the leading character in it, and it's something that is really worth taking a look at.
Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. Russell Banks, do you continue to read Twain today?
Yes, actually I do, one of the things I enjoy because he is he's so adept and seems so delighted when he's using spoken speech. I enjoy listening to him in the audio tapes as I drive.
Whose audio tapes do you listen to?
Oh, there are various sets. You had to ask me, didn't you?
I did. Well, because we're going to have one of the readers on in a few minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Carl Reiner's going to join us.
Uh-huh.
We'll look forward to asking him who he listens to. Russell Banks, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Russell Banks, the author of many books, including the novel Rule of the Bone. We reached him at his office in Keene, New York. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Freeman, and Freeman's in Rochester, New York.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Freeman.
Well, thank you so very much for taking my call. I've been a fan of Mark Twain for a number of years, and there are two things that I was interested in. I'm an African-American who have always appreciated Mark Twain, even in the midst of his humor, sort of uplifting a kind of integrity in the African-American people that he portrayed in his books. And I certainly wanted to ask your panel to speak to that. The other thing is about his marketing of his books. I have one of his original, I think what was called the seller's copy of Huckleberry Finn, and it has misspellings and misabbreviations, et cetera, in the book. And I was told that there was a time that the printers went from place to place to try to sell his book and in its original form, and also wanted to know about the accuracy of that.
Shelley Fishkin, can you help Freeman out?
Certainly. Well, on your first point, I think that you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more that Twain is an extraordinarily sensitive and interested and compassionate portrayer of African Americans. He didn't start out that way. He was the child of slaveholders, but he transformed his thinking over the course of his young adulthood and became one of the country's most profound critics of racism. And I think that, one of the lasting impacts of Huck Finn that's so important is that it helps each generation understand how to challenge the racism that may exist around them as, you know, like the air. I mean, racism that people around them may not be aware of, may not challenge. This book helps people ask questions themselves that allow them to transcend that, or to at least interrogate it in some important ways.
Yeah.
As far as the subscription book marketing, Twain did have door-to-door salesmen marketing his books, mm-hmm. and they had brochures that allowed people to get a sense of what would be in the book, and then they would print them after people placed their orders, and they had a sense of exactly what people wanted and how many books to print and what they would know. So that's great that you have one of those early brochures.
Well, I just want to thank you. I think he has been an enormous impact in my life in understanding that there have been generations and people in this nation who were not racist, who had the capacity to look at things realistically and to free us all to question how we treated one another. So I'm just delighted that you're doing this work. I really am.
Thank you very much, Freeman.
Yep.
Thank you.
And let's get one more caller in. Ken is with us, and Ken's in Denver, Colorado.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A couple of years ago, in Harper's Magazine, they published a story of Mr. Twain about, it was a retelling, I think, of the Adam and Eve story. And in the article, in the background, they talked about the Mark Twain Trust and how there were certain documents that Mr. Twain had and stipulated that they wouldn't be able to be published until X number of years after his death. And I wondered if some of your guests knew about that and when they would be released.
Shelley Fishkin?
Thank you. I'll take my answer.
Well,
the
good news is that all of that material is something that can be released now, and the Mark Twain Project at the University of California, Berkeley, is publishing Twain's unpublished works. His recent volume of letters that just came out. A number of the works that Twain designated to be published after his death have been published. Letters from the Earth, the material that you're referring to relating to Adam and Eve may have been from that volume. And so I think I view him as our most prolific dead author in that he is constantly coming up with new material, or rather we are constantly uncovering new things that he wrote that are worth reading. And that's why I really welcome the fact that there's this new Jumping Frog series of undiscovered and rediscovered and celebrated works by Twain that University of California is going to be publishing and is publishing. Is He Dead is part of that new series because there is a lot there. And some of it was not published in his lifetime, and some of the things that were published in his lifetime fell by the wayside and weren't really paid attention to. So there really is a lot more of Twain for us to enjoy.
I think he would have liked that description as America's most prolific dead author. Shelley Fisher Fishkin, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Shelley Fishkin is the editor of the newly released Mark Twain play, Is He Dead? And she's the author of several books on Twain. She's also director of Stanford University's American Studies Department. She was with us from the school's studios in Palo Alto, California. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. While Twain never made it big on the stage, except for one play, many of his books were adapted into successful plays by other playwrights during his lifetime, and now actor Carl Reiner is undertaking a new kind of Twain performance, recording his works as audiobooks, including the cynical and funny Letters from the Earth, Twain's take on every subject from James Fenimore Cooper to God's dubious gift of life and death to man.
Life was not a valuable gift, but death was. Life was a fever dream made up of joys embittered by sorrows, pleasure poisoned by pain, a dream that was a nightmare confusion of spasmodic and fleeting delights, ecstasies, exultations, happinesses, interspersed with long-drawn miseries, griefs, perils, horrors, disappointments, defeats, humiliations, and despairs. The heaviest curse devisable by divine ingenuity. But death was sweet. Death was gentle. Death was kind. Death healed the bruised spirit and the broken heart and gave them rest and forgetfulness. Death was man's best friend.
Carl Reiner joins us now from his home in Los Angeles, and good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Hey, you know, that's absolutely amazing that you played that particular piece, because I cracked open a little book here of which quotes much of Twain. It's called Bite-Sized Twain, and I thumbed through it, and in it was a thing from Letters from the Earth. And, you know, the amazing thing about that book, which came out 50 years after he... It came out in 1950, actually, 50-some years after he died. And his take on death and how it was supposed to salve people. You know, death was going to be the last release of pain. And in the Old Testament, there was no such thing as hell. And the New Testament fixed it up. Here's the quote I'm reading. In time, the deity perceived that death was a mistake. It allowed the dead person to escape from all further persecution and the blessed refuge of the grave. This was not satisfactory. A way must be contrived to pursue the dead beyond the tomb. He invented hell and proclaimed it. Isn't that amazing?
That's great stuff.
Yes, I couldn't believe that you were playing something from Letters. And here I had this book open to this. That is, what do we call that, synchronicity?
Well, we just have about 30 seconds left. We've got to take a break. But I did want to ask you, why did you record Letters from the Earth? I know you've done Tom Sawyer and The Prince and the Pauper. Why this one next?
Well, because it was little known, and it fed into my feelings about religion and organized religion and how God was perceived and how God came to us, how we know about God, and he had his take on it. And by the way, I have my take on it, and I'm reading something here, his excerpts from Adam's diary, and I've decided that man did write the Bible and did write his version of Genesis. Somebody wrote it. It was a writer, and Mark Twain was a writer who wrote about it. And I'm a television writer, and why can't I do my version of it? And that's what I'm living with right now.
We're talking with Twain fan Carl Reiner. We'll have more after a break, including more of your email challenges. TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. Today we're celebrating Mark Twain's birthday. It was actually yesterday, with a look at his legacy in American culture and society. Our guest is a comedian, writer, broadcaster Carl Reiner, who's released several audiobooks of Twain's works. And Carl Reiner, we talk about Twain's literary legacy, but as a comedian yourself, what do you take from him as a comic?
Oh, well, you take laughter. And then you take education. He educates you as he makes you laugh. And it's amazing. I'm asked very often, why do some things last, some television shows last? Why do they become classics? Here's two. I want to quote him twice in this little book of Bite-Sized Twain. Listen to this. Humor must not professedly teach. It must not professedly preach. But it must do both if it would live forever. How about that? Laughter without a tinge of philosophy is but a sneeze of humor. Genuine humor is replete with wisdom. And I think everything that's worthwhile in, in literature that lasts has both humor and some information that you need for life.
What are you getting out of doing all these recordings?
Oh, you know what I'm getting? I'm getting a chance to really digest Twain. You read sometimes cursorily, but when you have to read it out loud for other people, you dig a little more into the meaning of things. By the way, I've done the Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, The Prince and the Pauper, Letters from Earth, and What is Man? And somebody said, would you like to do all of them? And I said, well, they're 37. I don't know how many. I'm 81. There's no way. There's no way. Unless that's the reason I hang in there to do all of Twain. It would be an awfully good reason.
Well, we just found a new play, which has just been published, so maybe even more than you thought.
Yes. Let's... Oh, it's amazing how things keep popping. You know, I'm reading something in Adam's diary, and I laughed out loud. I found myself laughing out loud. I would read it to you, but you don't have time, do you?
How long is it?
Well, it's a paragraph.
Oh, I think we can go ahead.
Oh, he's talking about, this is excerpts from Adam's diary. He's talking about Eve. Been examining the great waterfall. It's the finest thing on the estate, I think. The new creature, he talks, that's Eve. The new creature calls it Niagara Falls. Why? I'm sure I don't know. Says it looks like Niagara Falls. This is not a reason. It's a mere waywardness of imbecility. I get no chance to name anything myself. The new creature names everything that comes along before I can get in a protest. And always the same pretext is offered. It looks like the thing. There is the doo-doo, for instance. Says the moment one looks at it, one sees at a glance that it looks like a doo-doo. It will have to keep that name, no doubt. It wearies me to fret about it, and it does no good anyway. Doo-doo. It looks no more like doo-doo than I do. How about that? I've laughed at that last line.
Let's get a caller on the line. Jeffrey's with us from Syracuse, New York.
Did you giggle a little at that?
I did giggle a little bit at that.
Quietly.
I did.
And so did I. Mr. Reiner was mentioning Letters from the Earth. I have two close friends who both ended up in the clergy, one an Episcopal priest and the other Presbyterian. And in both their seminaries, they were required to read Letters from the Earth.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to help, I think, prick the balloons of the overly pious who, you know, often show up in those places. And you know, with the problem of proclaiming to have the true religion, et cetera. And I think one of the quotes from there is that man is the only animal with true religion, several of them, and he's always ready to slit his neighbor's throat to set his theology straight. And he has that little parable about the descent of man from the higher animals, where he manages to take young animals and put them in the cage and get them to live harmoniously together. But then he takes a Scottish Presbyterian, an Irish Catholic, and a Salvation Army colonel and some others and puts them in a cage and comes back 2 weeks later and finds that they've torn each other to shreds. They got into a theological detail, he says, tore themselves to shreds in order to take it to a higher court.
I love that. That particular book has so many things in it that make you think. And when he talks about when the letter comes from Satan to heaven, and he says, you know the heaven he's invented for himself? He's where everybody sings, and how many sing on keys, but everybody sings and plays the harp. And the one thing that we cherish and love so much on earth is not there. There's no sex in heaven. How could he leave that out?
He says it's Hal Holbrook. Fair phrase, and he says, heaven for climate, hell for society.
I meant to ask you, Carl Reiner, before you started recording all this stuff, did you check with Hal Holbrook? Doesn't he have the franchise?
Hal Holbrook, to me, is a force of nature. When I was, in many, many years ago, when he first started doing it in New York, I took my two young children, Robbie, who was 12, and my daughter, Annie, and we took them to the Manhattan Theater, which was a very old theater. There were rugs on the floor. There were folding chairs down in the basement, and a man came on stage. The smell of musk was in the air. It was that old a theater. And when Hal Holbrook came on as Mark Twain, I was transported in time, never forgot that day and never forgot him. And as a matter of fact, I actually paid Andy Griffith, who said, I don't go to theaters, as you've got to see Hal Holbrook do Mark Twain. And he said, no, I don't go. I gave him $25 in cash, and I put it in his hand. I said, you owe me the visit to Mark, and he went and paid me the money back. he's the best time I've ever had in my life. No, Hal Holbrook is he's the master. The master. I did a birthday party for Eisenhower, the Eisenhower birthday party, and Mark Twain, in the form of Hal Holbrook, was there. The Lennon sisters and myself, we all entertained, and at the very end, the president came back to shake our hands and say hello, and I never forgot this. When he met Hal Holbrook, who was still in his Mark Twain outfit, the president deferred to him. It was not Mark Twain who bowed to the president. Mark Twain was a figure of history, and Eisenhower actually took a step back and sort of bowed to him and treated him with the dignity that you would a royal figure. It was an amazing moment that I will never forget. I feel that way about Hal Holbrook.
His portrayal of when he reads from Huckleberry Finn and plays the part, back when Hal Holbrook was a little younger, he's playing, you know, he is 35, 40, playing a 65, 70-year-old man playing a 12-year-old boy. That's an extraordinary performance.
Oh, he's absolutely a brilliant actor. You know, I try to improve his performance because he was smoking a cigar through the whole thing, as Twain did, and he was smoking a Candela wrapper, which is a green cigar, and I bought him a box of beautiful Havana cigars, and he said, and I said, it's anachronism because the green Candela wrapper didn't come until later on when the cigarettes became, in the 20s, when the cigarettes became popular and they made it cosmetically more prettier. And Holbrook, I was going to call him Twain, said to me, he says, yeah, but that's a very strong cigar. This is a very, he's like, I'll forget the authenticity part of it and save my throat.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for the call.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We appreciate it. And Carl Reiner, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for celebrating the great man's birthday.
Carl Reiner is an actor, writer, director, and producer currently working on a series of audio recordings of the works of Mark Twain available from New Millennium Audio. We caught him at his home in Los Angeles, California. And remember, you can find out more on our show about Mark Twain at our website at www.npr.org. And here are a couple of the stories that we're following at NPR News today. The CEO of Boeing is stepping down. His resignation comes amid ethics questions related to Boeing's huge and growing stake in defense contracts. And one top U.S. military official says yesterday's ambushes in northern Iraq are something larger than past attacks. The Army says 54 Iraqis were killed in a firefight in the town of Samarra. Those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.